oversight committees on the Hill, when they found out about this, just started hyperventilating and looked at this as, you know, an instance potentially of domestic spying.
Today on Reason TV, we're speaking with Shane Harris, the author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. Thank you for coming on, Shane.
Thanks for having me.
Your book opens with an explosion, which is always a good decision, I think. The bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut in 1983. Why is that the place that you start the story of surveillance in America?
Well, going back and researching sort of the history of terrorist attacks and often what was known before the attack within the intelligence community, I found a lot of sort of eerie parallels between 9/11 and Beirut. Beirut is also important for the first reason is that it was really the first instance of religious, suicidal, Islamic terrorism against an American target. It was a very dramatic explosion. 241 Marines were killed. The last time they lost that many men in one day, they were actually storming the beaches at Iwo Jima. So it was really sort of a watershed moment. But in going back and researching what happened before that event, I found that just like 9/11, there were very significant clues that were missed. For instance, individual warnings about car bombings. In the previous 6 months in Beirut, the intelligence community actually had intercepted or fielded 100 different warnings about car bombings in Lebanon, and none of them were really followed up on or fused. There was an investigation of a previous bombing, actually, at the U.S. Embassy that held a lot of clues for what kind of terrorists were operating in Lebanon. And then there were actually intercepted phone calls between sources in Iran and terrorist elements in Lebanon, ordering them to undertake some kind of attack against the Americans. And none of this intelligence was ever actually shared with the Marines on the ground so that they could fortify their positions. So it was just this sort of eerie kind of theme that was developing of missing the dots before the attack and only afterwards realizing the significance of all these disparate fragments of intelligence and realizing that nobody in government had ever really put them together. And this book is about those people who were trying to do that. And 83 was really sort of the first instance of anyone making a concerted effort to connect those dots.
Let's talk about the phrase connect the dots, because every time something happens, immediately afterward, you get the cable news, you know, failures to connect the dots story. And as a person who doesn't really know that much about the specific sort of technical side of this, it seems like it's easy to understand mm-hmm. how someone wouldn't have connected those dots, but it's also infuriating that they missed it, that, you know, so much was at stake and so much, you know, time, energy, money has been poured into intelligence in order to miss this important stuff. Where do you kind of come down in that divide? I mean, should we at this point, given the sort of technology and, you know, intelligence capabilities that we have, be able to connect, say, the dots for the underwear bomber on Christmas Day?
Right, yeah. Well, to take the underwear bomber is a really good instance. You know, there's a case where arguably, yes, we should have been able to connect fragments of information that we had. That wasn't an instance where we didn't have enough information on potential threats. Now, granted, even if you'd connected all of those various pieces of intelligence, which included warnings from his father coming into an embassy saying he'd gone to Yemen, intercepted phone calls from al-Qaeda operatives in Yemen talking about a Nigerian that they'd employed in an operation, the fact that the suspected terrorist's name was put into a database on a watch list, it's kind of appalling in a way that more wasn't done to try and fuse those different streams of intelligence to say, wait a minute, there seems to be a pattern here, or we're hearing things about Nigerians and we're getting a guy coming into the embassy and should we be following up on that? And I was really sort of shocked to learn that after that event that there was no automated system in place for once you put someone's name in the master watch list of suspected terrorists, of which, by the way, there are 500 million names, which is a whole other problem of information overload. There's no automated system to check if the name you're putting in has actually already been given a U.S. visa. So you've got this database of names of people who we probably want to think about keeping out of the country, and we don't automatically check the records that would tell us if they've been given permission to enter the country. So, I mean, I think in a way, it's you could argue that even in hindsight, if all these pieces were known and the puzzle was there, maybe somebody would not have actually seen the pattern or realized the significance of it. But those pieces were never even put together on the table, and the reasons for it really come down to bureaucratic obstacles, agencies not wanting to share their information, not wanting to connect their different databases because they want to protect sources and methods. And frankly, information in Washington is power. And the more you control the access to your intelligence, the more powerful you are as an agency. But then there are just sort of these basic technological issues of, you know, not being able to automatically check one name in a database against another. And, you know, those kinds of things should be the easy fixes. And it's sort of shocking in a way that 9 years after 9/11, those fixes just haven't been made in some cases.
Right. And in 1983, it's not so surprising, right, that,
yeah,
you know, car bomb and Beirut wouldn't be cross-indexable. But in the age of Google, we think everything should be sort of double searchable in this way.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the rise of kind of easy access to information by the general public and how that's impacted the way that the surveillance state operates, you know?
Well, it's definitely changing in a couple of ways. One, I think they've watched this technological kind of revolution occur and realized that now information is out there and freely available in ways that they could only have imagined maybe a generation ago. I mean, I think that if you could jump in a time machine and go back to 1983 and say to somebody in the intelligence community, you know, one day there will be this grand electronic database of names, and it will show who everyone is connected to and what their hobbies are and where they're going today and where they've been, and it's going to be called the Facebook. You know, they would have asked, you know, well, when did the Russians win the war, and when did this kind of system come into place? This is sort of this, like, that would be considered almost totalitarian and sort of Orwellian, I guess, in a sense. But, you know, so I think they're looking at this, you know, this revolution and saying, wow, okay, this has happened. Now how do we take advantage of it?
In the book, you do describe one point where the commingling of confidential and non-confidential information sort of leads to this, I guess you could say, almost a constitutional crisis and results in the shutting down of a promising program. Can you describe how that happened?
Yeah, this was a program, it was a Special Operations Command program known as Able Danger, and it began in early 2000, and the idea here was that military commanders wanted to get a sense of what the global network of al-Qaeda looked like. And al-Qaeda had, at that point, had just attacked the two embassies in Africa in 98. This is, you know, almost a year and a half before 9/11. So they're on the radar of military commanders in the intelligence community, but they don't know how vast the network is. And so they employ this small unit at the Army Intelligence Command to use this very innovative kind of data mining, where they're going to go through classified government databases of cable traffic intelligence reports to find what they have in al-Qaeda, but they're also going to go out and mine information on the internet. Now, remember, this is 2000. This is pre-Google. The internet is sort of a novel source of information, and they're going to go out and crawl the web, essentially, to see what information they can find, too, and then they bring that into their databases as well and marry it up with the government intelligence and create these sort of elaborate diagrams of al-Qaeda figures and where they are. Well, the lawyers at the Army look at that, and they say, wait a second, you're drawing in information from public sources, a lot of which contains references to U.S. persons, to American citizens, just because they happen to be on the same web page or mentioned in the same chat room thread as these suspected terrorists or al-Qaeda figures. You're pulling that in, putting it in a government database, mixing it with classified intelligence. This is a violation of privacy regulations. And, you know, the lawyers and then oversight committees on the Hill, when they found out about this, just started hyperventilating and looked at this as, you know, an instance potentially of domestic spying. And the orders that they gave to the people, the analysts who were doing this in Able Danger, was shut the program down and destroy everything that you've discovered to date, because the rules say you have to purge the records of any references to U.S. persons. And this became rather controversial when 5 years later it was discovered this program was running and that they actually had early signs of some kind of al-Qaeda presence in the United States. It was very vague. They needed to go deeper on it to find out whether it was real or credible, but they never had the chance to look because the lawyers effectively came in and said, that's domestic spying, you're over the line of privacy, shut it down and destroy everything, which is exactly what they did.
Do you think that was the right call?
I mean, ultimately, I think that they were reading their privacy regulations and the restrictions very narrowly, but we look at that now and we think, how absurd the idea that the government can't actually go out and look at publicly available information to try and form some kind of hypothesis about al-Qaeda. And they weren't targeting people. They weren't pulling these names in and then investigating Americans. It was just a byproduct of the search. I mean, we know this when we go out today and you Google yourself and find all kinds of references and connections to other people. And we sort of understand that, you know, there's sort of an innocuous kind of aspect to this. At the same time, you know, when you're talking about pulling that information into a government database, yes, you have to be more skeptical and the rules have to be tighter. But I think at the time the lawyers were probably overreacting given the nature of the mission that these guys had and what they were actually doing with the information, which was not following up on Americans and trying to profile U.S. persons or anything like that. They were just sort of trying to get a handle on the universe of information about al-Qaeda.
Thank you very much, Shane Harris, for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Catherine Mengi Ward for Reason TV.